Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, the 18th of July, 2002. Today's session is entitled Women's Ways of Reading the Bible in Brazil and is hosted by Wanda Diefeld. This is session DEW 2002-03. Let's listen in.
So, good evening. My name is Wanda Diefeld, and I'm from Brazil. And our subject this evening is going to be women's ways of reading the Bible in Brazil. And why I think that's an interesting subject for you is because the way the Bible is read, I think, in Latin America is quite different from the way it is done in congregations in the United States, because of the setting, because of the context, and because of the impact that the biblical reading has had in Latin America. First of all, I think it's important to say that in Brazil, as well as in many of the Latin American countries, the fact that women are illiterate is a common fact. The fact that women do not know how to read or write will, of course, have a very strong influence in the access people also have to biblical reading. Most of us come from a Lutheran European background in which we presuppose that having access to education is for everybody. Well, it's not that the case in Latin America. And so it demands a lot of creativity on one's part to do Bible studies when people do not have the capacity of following a text and discussing what is written the same way as most of you are accustomed to doing. So that's the first challenge. There are some situations in which we do have Bible studies or we do have worship, and you do know that even people who are quite very active participants in the congregation, when you share with them the Bible to read the text you're studying, or if you open the songbook and you share with them, and the majority of the women will say, no, thank you, Pastor, I forgot my glasses at home. And you know that in reality they don't know how to read and write, but they are so embarrassed to even say that. They make up excuses for their own capacity or the lack of capacity of reading and writing. And the second observation that I find important to share with you is, since Brazil, as many, the majority of the countries in Latin America, was colonized by Spanish and Portuguese, and Roman Catholicism has been the official religion up till the beginning of the 19th century. Everybody had to be Roman Catholic. It has only been maybe less than 100 years that Roman Catholicism is not the official religion of the state. The influence of Roman Catholicism also has to do with the access that people have to the Bible. You know that one of the strong points of the Reformation was precisely Luther's pledge, Luther's interest, and Luther's struggle, that people would have access to reading the Bible and do it also in their own language. And the initiatives that Martin Luther had in translating the Bible into German so that the people, the common people, would be able to read as well. Well, that's not the case in Brazil, because most of the Roman Catholic setting, most of the priests in the Roman Catholic parishes, the Bible was considered something putting it softly, something not very important, because we say that the Protestant religion is a religion of the word. You know, the preaching of the word is important. And in Roman Catholic setting, the sacrament, the symbolic element, would be much more important. I mean, that's a very rough distinction between these two denominations, but it does show the impact and the lack of knowledge that most of the people have about biblical figures, for instance. And ever since the Second Vatican, the Council in the Roman Catholic Church, there has been a significant opening to the ecumenical movement, and also to the integration of what were not so-called traditional modes of Roman Catholicism. And that meant also a strong interest in reading the Bible. Well, if you can imagine the impact that the biblical readings had in Latin America in the past years, you would you would not recognize the Bible as it is, and the novelty that reading the Bible really represents. Because it's almost like going to the Reformation all over again. The same experience that Luther had in reading the Bible and having that as a revelation for his life, for the life of the people of his time, is more or less what is happening nowadays in Latin America with the rediscovery of the Bible and the importance that the Bible has had in the life of people. There is one Roman Catholic theologian called Carlos Masters, and he has been one of the persons who advocated a popular reading of the Bible. And I'm circulating among you, it's on the table there, please pass it around to take a look. How the Bible and commentaries about the Bible have been made available in such an elementary language, in a very popular way, through storytelling, through imagery that is part of everyday life of the people. And Carlos Masters has a saying that the Bible in Latin America was like this beautiful house that all the people used to have access to. Because in the history of the church, the Bible used to be the memory of the common people. And then, as the time went by, this beautiful house was left only to the experts, and only people who knew Hebrew and Greek and who could make the comments, or who would have a special ministry in the church, would be capable of doing biblical interpretation. And this dissociation between the life of the common people and the life of the common people of the Bible, because what the Bible really says is related to the everyday experience of generations past, of people who witness the presence of God in their lives and who want to leave a message to others, as to proclaim the good news of God's presence throughout history. And Carlos Masters then has a parable in which this house that was kept in anonymity by the experts is finally reclaimed by the common people themselves. And the impact that that has had is that the especially the poor, people from Christian-based communities, people who are involved in social changes, will see, well, God has acted in favor of the poor, God has acted in favor of the oppressed in the past, and God is doing it nowadays as well. So it is like seeing the Bible as this family picture, a family album of pictures that you will see all the people who have gone before you and say, well, I'm part of this tradition, this is my heritage, and this is something that I take in my own ownership as well. But that has not always been the case, because as I said, in the Roman Catholic setting, the Mass uses elements of the biblical text, but the Bible in itself does not have such an important acknowledgement as we have in the Protestant setting. To give you one example, I was doing some ecumenical work, and I was working in one of the parishes in the state of Mato Grosso, which is in the Amazon area. And I was quite surprised in doing my practical work that the priest would allow me to preach every week. And I thought, for a Lutheran, this is quite a compliment, you know, that the priest lets you preach every week. So, of course, I prepared the sermon because you know how it is. As we saw it yesterday night with Mary's beautiful sermon, there is a lot of effort, there's a lot of work that goes into preparing a sermon, because not only do you have to read the biblical text, you have to study the text, you have to find the appropriate ways of convening that message to the reality of the people. So, of course, I put a lot of effort into that. And he, of course, would never let me celebrate the Eucharist, because that is the holy of the holiest, you know? And that is the most important aspect. It's not preaching, it's communion. And I was quite astonished in realizing that in one of the weeks in which I could not do the preaching, that priest had simply got a note of what the text was for that Mass 5 minutes before the Mass actually started. And I was shocked, and saw a lack of respect for the importance of the biblical text. And I think that shows a little bit of the denominational differences. Since then, I'm happy to share this information with you. In the seminaries, at least in Brazil, much more importance has been given also to preparing seminarians to go out and do sermons that have the quality that the congregation expects from them. And that has also been in great part due to the Second Vatican Council, but also as a reflection of the ecumenical movement itself. The use of the Bible in the Christian-based communities has always been as a tool for liberation, meaning to say the Bible needs to have something to say to people in that context, and it needs to announce hope, it needs to announce a celebration, as Andrea was sharing the other day when she was speaking about the way the Afro-Americans preach. Yes, there needs to be an aspect of liberation, of celebration in the interpretation of the biblical text. But in our setting, there is another element which is really important, which is that of empowerment. If we have experienced 500 years of colonialism in Latin America, now more than 500 years, that has meant that always a very small group of people, meaning to say the elite, has been the representative of humanity. For them, God has always been on the side of the rich, God has always been on the side of the powerful, and the others who are at the fringe of society, who are poor, who are dispossessed, are so because God has not favored them, because they are lazy and so on. That's a type of theology that is that's an inheritance of colonial times, and unfortunately is still maintained nowadays by many of these neo-Pentecostal churches that preach a prosperity theology. So there needs to be a sense of empowerment, this ethical dimension that a biblical text empowers one to be also an agent of God's good news in our society nowadays. It's not only the exercise of the mind, it's not only the knowledge that I have about the text, the knowledge that I have of God's presence in the past, but how does that empower me to also make a difference in my own life, in the life of those who surround me, and in the context in which I live? So this dimension of empowerment. And furthermore, also a dimension of critique. The critique goes towards oneself. It's not only because I'm poor, because I'm oppressed, because I'm at the fringe of society, because I'm excluded from the power, hierarchical power, that I am perfect, that I am already justified. And that, I think, is a critique that goes towards oneself, towards one's own community, but also a critique that goes to society as a whole, to our whole, our own culture, the mentality, and those values that we keep perpetuating. In saying that, in sharing this information, I want to also clarify that this is pretty much a model of reading the Bible that is developed already by liberation theology. But I want to show to you why there is a need also for doing it from a feminist perspective, in which using the classical definition of feminism as a movement that seeks equality between men and women, how that came about to be in my own life, and it came about to be in the lives of many women. And here I want to share with you a story to explain why I moved away from purely liberation theology into a feminist theology. It's like, how did I become a feminist in Brazil? I was doing my internship precisely in this Christian-based community in the Amazon area many years ago, part of my practical experience, my internship. And we were living in a community. There was a priest, there was a nun, there was a pastoral agent, and we all lived as in the same way as the rest of the village lived. And the village was maybe less in population than Holden Village, but maybe a dozen little houses, all of them made with mud. The walls were mud, the roof was straw, and the ground where we stepped on was just earth. And there was no running water. We had to go down to the stream to get the water and to bathe in the rim and wash our clothes at the river. There was no electricity, and that is where I was working. This very simple, very nice Christian community. And one day they came in to the village, and the name of the place is Ribeirão Bonito, which in Portuguese means a beautiful stream. And you will notice there's some irony, especially in Latin America. People from the most, who live in the most despicable places, they name their houses, their towns, the streets, in the most beautiful name possible. So everything is related to happiness and hope, but actually the place where they live is quite miserable. And so in this place called Ribeirão Bonito, I was working one day with a congregation, and one woman came in. A woman and her husband, they had come from the inland, from the bush, and they had come to the village seeking medical assistance, because this was a case of pregnancy. A woman who was 32 years old, she had, this was her eighth pregnancy, she had had three miscarriages, and in this last pregnancy she had taken birth control pills without her husband knowing, but because she suffered from malnutrition, the birth control did not work because, you know, the hormones compensate for malnutrition. So a woman that is undernourished is actually more prone to getting pregnant than otherwise. So they came to the village because they knew it was going to be very complicated, and they called a medical doctor, and the medical doctor was brought in. She came from a neighboring village, but then they thought that once the medical doctor could not do anything any longer, they should better have somebody who was a priest or a pastor or even a student of theology to help when this medical doctor could no longer do. So I volunteered to go. The name of the woman was Maria. Maria is a very common name in Latin America. It means Mary. So Maria was brought to the only house in the whole village that had a bed because everybody slept in hammocks. So in order to deliver the baby, she needed to have a bed. So that was the only house that had a bed. And she was brought in, and all of us were helping her in the labor. And she started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was a very difficult labor because she was so weak and so frail. And then by 8 o'clock in the evening, almost 9 o'clock, a child was born. It was another girl. She had two girls already. And it was really a surprise because the girl was beautiful. She was, her cheeks were, you know, fat. So we were all celebrating the birth of this baby. And as the baby was being washed and carried out, Maria was not feeling very well. And she started bleeding. And she started with a hemorrhage. And We didn't quite know what to do because after all this long labor, Maria was so weak that we were sure that she was going to die. Her face was completely pale and she had lost all her color. And we didn't know exactly what to do. And then the medical doctor had in her bag a syringe to inject medication to stop the bleeding, and that I thought was almost, you know, a coincidence, because how would she know what medication to bring along? And as the medical doctor was trying to find a vein in Maria's arm, and the arm was so thin, and she couldn't find a vein, so she kept poking her several times to find a vein. And then finally she found one, and the medication started to take effect, and Maria was slowly recovering, and her color was coming back again, and the blood that was streaming down from the bed onto the ground stopped flowing, and we were all, you know, like a sigh of relief, because we had just witnessed a miracle. And the miracle was not the birth of a baby, but the miracle was that the mother had not died. And I started to realize that that was the situation for most women in the country, in which the conditions of health, of knowing about their own bodies, access to medication, and the basic things that you take for granted are not a part of women's experiences in Brazil. And then the medical doctor, she said to Maria, quite honestly, if she were to go through another experience like that, if she became pregnant again, that she would most certainly not survive. And that she suggested that she would do a tubal ligation, which is a very common way of very common surgery in Brazil, so much so that nowadays it's estimated that 40% of the women who use any form of contraceptive have undergone tubal ligations, because it's become quite popular. And so the doctor suggested that she do that, and even if she did not have the money, that the clinic could help her in paying for this, that there would be no financial problems, because nowadays there are so many agencies, international agencies, that are promoting tubal ligation. Maybe some of you know about that as well. And so she was offering this to Maria. And Maria, she turned her head away from us. She was looking very attentively to us. And she just turned her head toward the wall to avoid looking us in the eye. And she said, it's not up to me to decide. You have to ask my husband. And so the doctor went out and I followed her. And the doctor called the husband aside and explained very carefully, in a very comprehensive manner, all the dangers, all the perils of another pregnancy, and suggested this surgery. And can you imagine what he answered?
No.
He said no. He said, I will not allow it. I will not allow it, because what will my body say if I do not put any more children in the world? They will think that I am no longer a man. Because malehood is measured by the amount of children that you put in the world. And he said, if she dies, I'll find me another one that's younger and prettier. And that's the day when I became a feminist. Unfortunately, I don't know what happened to Maria, because she was brought back to her home. But I know that this day, we started working in the village about how we as women could prevent situations like that. And the women themselves said, there should be something written in the Bible, because the Bible is an authority. And interestingly enough, in all the work that I had done beforehand with Christian-based communities and popular reading of the Bible, the subject of empowering women, in liberating women, in making a critique about women's situation in society, had not been one of the strong points, because we just thought that if we were talking about the liberation of the poor in general, that women's liberation would follow. And we realized, well, even in Christian-based communities, the situation of oppression of men and women is so terrible that something needed to be done. And we realized that it was necessary, and we did this. The women who had helped in the labor, and the women who were leaders in these Christian-based communities, and we said, well, we need to find means in the Bible to critique our own society and to say to women that they can have the strength, they have the power, they have the people who can help to intervene, and also to empower the whole community to intervene in situations like this. Because in our very machista culture in Latin America, nobody will intervene when there is a problem between a husband and a wife, because that is a man's authority, and one should never question a man's authority. But then we realized, well, how deadly, how harmful that can actually be. And so the women ourselves, we started to a series of Bible studies of looking for the empowerment of women. And I want to share with you some of the different topics that have since become popular for us to discuss in Brazil. First, because we wanted to find women heroes. We wanted to show, well, women do have capacities. Women were present in the Bible the same way as women are present to nowadays in Christian communities, in any church, and that women do have that strength, that capacity, that capability of taking ownership of our own lives and making decisions also in the most basic situations that deal with our own bodies, with our own reproduction, with our own health, and the lives of those who surround us. And I'm going to mention these, and afterwards I want you to be thinking, what are some of the important women of the Bible and some of the role models that you have found in your lives based off in some of the experiences that you have had and those of that you have faced. In the first years when we started to do this in Brazil, in particularly when we have started with this ecumenical center for biblical interpretation, which is the publishing house that puts out some of the material that is circulating among you. We were looking for women who were heroes. We were looking for those like Deborah, who was a leader. We were looking for the Samaritan woman, somebody who had defied society at her time, somebody who has had five husbands, you know. It's like, do you know how many women in Latin America have that or more amount of husbands? It's like, yeah, I mean, these are good women. See, Jesus did not reprimand them, but said, you know, you go and you go announce. And to this woman, Jesus revealed himself as Messiah. We were looking for women like Mary Magdalene, and even though it's not biblical, and you probably will confirm that her reputation of being of somebody of a questionable background when it comes to morals is something that the church imposed on her afterwards, even though the Bible does not have anything to say. But in Latin America, saying somebody is a Mary Magdalene is a synonym to being a prostitute. But then we were looking for Mary Magdalene to say to herself, to her, Jesus appeared for the first time as the resurrected one. And see, even though we did not find any proof of that ill reputation in the Bible, the people said, oh look, Jesus appeared first to a woman of ill reputation, you know. That is the type of reading that they were doing. Women like Mary, Mary as the mother of Jesus, the one who announced in the Magnificat that God will side with the poor, that God will remove from their thrones those who are powerful and mighty, and will uplift those who are considered the humble ones. Women like Huldah and all of the women who were friends with Jesus, like Martha and Mary, these were women that became very, very important as role models in the Christian communities, because women were for the first time in their lives hearing that there were women in the circle of friends of Jesus, because they had only heard, oh well, because Jesus did not have 12, Jesus only had 12 male disciples. That means that women do not count as disciples at all. That's the type of theology that they had always heard, and that meant to say, oh, of course, you know, we are not part of that. And then finding all of these women has been a source of empowerment. But that was in the first years. And then we immediately saw, like in the stories of that we were living and experiencing, stories like the one of Maria that I just told, but the many, many stories of women who had been tortured under military dictatorship, or women who had experienced domestic violence or sexual abuse. And then we started looking for the women who were martyrs in the Bible. And then, if you know, a book that came out by Phyllis Trible many years ago called Texts of Terror. Have you heard of this? It's a book that shows some of the texts of terror in the Bible itself. Not by coincidence, we were studying many of these texts already in Brazil when this book came out, because that was part of our reality of women being almost slaughtered. And then the women like in Judges 19, the concubine, the Levite's concubine, who has run away and then is given. Do you know this story? Judges 19. Would you like to read it? I mean, it's a very interesting, fascinating story. We could. Do you have Bibles? Should I go back and to some of the women that I mentioned beforehand, the ones that that are in the circle of Jesus? Should I tell you which passages these are in? Do you know about those? Do you know about those that I mentioned? Barbara, she's the New Testament doctor, you know. She can have a whole session on...
Judges 19, that's a good one.
Judges 19.
It's a terrible story.
It's a terrible story. Does anybody want to read it? Can you read it? Judges 19.
The whole chapter?
Yeah.
In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, who took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine became angry with him, and she went away from him to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there some 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and bring her back. He had with him his servant and a couple of asses, and he came to her father's house. And when the girl's father saw him, he came with joy to meet him. And his father-in-law, the girl's father, made him stay, and he remained with him 3 days. So they ate and drank and lodged there. And on the 4th day, they arose early in the morning, and he prepared to go. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread, and after that you may go. So the two men sat and ate and drank together. And the girl's father said to the man, "Be pleased to spend the night, and let your heart be merry." And when the man rose up to go, his father-in-law urged him till he lodged there again. And on the 5th day he rose early in the morning to depart. And the girl's father said, "Strengthen your heart and tarry until the day declines." So they ate, both of them. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, "Behold, now the day has waned toward evening. Pray tarry all night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here and let your heart be merry. And tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and go home." But the man would not spend the night. He rose up and departed and arrived opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. He had with him a couple of saddled asses, and his concubine was with him. When they were near Jebus, the day was far spent, and the servant said to his master, "Come now, let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites and spend the night in it." And his master said to him, "We will not turn aside into the city of foreigners who do not belong to the people of Israel, but we will pass on to Gibeah." And he said to his servant, "Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah." So they passed on and went their way, and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go in and spend the night at Gibeah. And he went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no man took them into his house to spend the night. And behold, an old man was coming from his work in the field at evening. The man was from the hill country of Ephraim and was sojourning in Gibeah. the men of the place were Benjamites. And he lifted up his eyes and saw the wayfarer in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going, and whence do you come?" And he said to him, "We are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to my home, and nobody takes me into his house. We have straw and provender for our asses, with bread and wine for me and your maidservant, and the young man with your servants. There is no lack of anything." And the old man said, "Peace be to you. I will care for all your wants. Only do not spend the night in the square." So he brought him into his house and gave the asses provender, and they washed their feet and ate and drank. As they were making their hearts merry, behold, the men of the city, base fellows, beset the house round about, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, "Bring out the man who came into your house, that we may know him." And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my brethren, do not act so wickedly. Seeing that this man has come into my house, do not do this vile thing. Behold, here are my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out now. Ravish them and do with them what seems good to you. But against this man, do not do so vile a thing." But the men would not listen to him. So the man seized his concubine and put her out to them. And they knew her and abused her all night until morning. And as the dawn began to break, they let her go. As the morning appeared, the woman came and fell down at the door of the man's house where her master was, till it was light. And her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let us be going." But there was no answer. Then he put her upon the ass, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, and laying hold of his concubine, he divided her, limb by limb, into 12 pieces, and sent her throughout all the territory of Israel. And all who saw it said, "Such a thing has never happened or been seen from the day that the people of Israel came up out of the land of Egypt until this day. Consider it, take counsel, and speak."
Well, for us in Brazil, as it is for you, when you first hear such a story and you see that this is in the Bible, there is a shock, because we are not accustomed to reading the Bible from cover to cover. You know, we just go to those parts that we are more knowledgeable of, or those texts that are prepared for our Sunday readings or for spiritual mentoring. For us, it has been very important to know that these are stories that are also present in the history of the people of God, and that we need to remember those whose memory has been part of the history of the people of the Bible in the past, in order to say that these things that are happening nowadays need to be denounced as well. And it's very powerful to use texts such as this for women who have suffered torture, for instance, or women who have been abused, and women who have suffered with domestic violence, because their story is part of this holy book. And it's like, yeah, I'm included, and my pain is there as well. And that was a very important stage. I think it was important for us to read the story. we have to go a little bit quicker in the other topics that have been present in our reading in Latin America, because I want to come to the last one. So we identified women as heroes, we identified women as martyrs, and then we also realized that there are many, many women whose names are not even presented. These are the anonymous women who have played such an important role in the Bible. And in reality, most of the women in the Bible do not have a name. They are just part of the crowd, they are part of the multitudes, they are part of the people who follow Jesus, or the part of the people, the Hebrew people. And many of them are so important that it's important for us to remember their doings and their sayings, even though they are names. And many, I'm just giving one example, because there are many more should be given. And there's a story about a woman that speaks out in the crowd in Luke 11, 27, 28, which, is quite short, and we could take a reading. It goes like this. A multitude is around Jesus, and he says this. A woman in the crowd raised her voice and said to him, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breasts that you sucked." But he said, "Blessed rather are those who bear the word of God and keep it." And only two verses, and it's so important when we talk about anonymous women. See, this woman, she spoke out of the crowd, and she immediately overcame a barrier that women could not speak publicly. And furthermore, she could not speak publicly and address a man. So what Jesus was saying to her was so liberating that she overcame some of the conditionments of her own society. But then when she opens her mouth, she says something that is quite conservative. She says, what does she say? She says, "Your mom is blessed because she gave you milk and because she put you into the world." She doesn't say anything, "Wow, your mom must be very proud of the type of son that she has, or because of the example of life that she gave you." And then Jesus goes even further than the woman, and because she was willing to get liberated, but you know, just a little bit. and then he says to her, "Well, blessed rather are those who hear the word of God and keep it." There is a parallel. It's like those who hear the word and put it into practice. Meaning to say, those who are disciples are blessed. And discipleship is much more than just being bound to the reproductive roles. It's like what society has always said and done to you. You know, the liberation is further than what you think. And sometimes you can learn a lot from the anonymity of women. And then finally we had to deal with all those women who are not heroes, because even though we started with heroines, we had to acknowledge that not all women in the Bible are treated as such. And so like Jezebel and so on. And then, for instance, in Acts 5, there's this interesting story of a couple that has newly converted to Christianity. And since in early Christianity, all the properties have to be shared, and this couple refused to sell their property, and they were punished for doing that. And one of, that's the name of the woman, that was Ananias and Sapphira. I don't know how you pronounce it in English. Is that more or less close enough? It's a very interesting story. Also, you can read it some other time. What we are doing right now in Brazil, in Latin America in general, is not look only for women characters. That was a very important stage in the development of a feminist hermeneutics, of a feminist way of reading the Bible. But we realized that only by acknowledging women, by naming these women and doing research about them, was not enough, because still we were addressing maybe one-fifth of the Bible, because what part of the Bible names women explicitly, you know? And then we are now starting this, and this is quite a recent development, and you can see it also in the publication, is to analyze how gender is constructed in the whole of the Bible and how it affects both women and how it affects also men. And if you have a Bible around and if you would like to read just the first verses of the Song of Solomon, which is quite a beautiful passage, can you read it? It's like verses chapter 1, 2 till... can get two to six.
Let's share the
yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Testing my
ability to remember which order things go in.
Well, that's why I passed it on to you.
Oh, here.
There you go. Excited to know.
The Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Oh, that you would kiss me with the kisses of your mouth, for your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out. Therefore, the maidens love you. Draw me after you. Let me make haste. The king has brought me into his chambers. We will exult and rejoice in you. We will extol your love more than wine. Rightly do they love you. How far do you want me to?
Until six.
I am very dark but comely. O daughters of Jerusalem, like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon, do not gaze at me because I am swarthy, because the sun has scorched me. My mother's sons were angry with me. They made me keeper of the vineyards, but my own vineyard I have not kept.
So what we have been doing with texts like this has become a quite knowledgeable text. First is to do that same asking for liberation, for the empowerment, and also for the critique. And one of the critiques, and here is where one's knowledge of Hebrew comes in quite handy. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a critique of the translation itself. If you have a Bible, open it in this page. Here it's 581. In that sentence it says, I'm very dark, but comely, but beautiful. Erase that, but, because it's the biggest translation mistake ever. It, in Hebrew it says, I'm very dark and I'm beautiful. See, it's like how racist interpretations are put into the translation itself. And how important it is for us to do that, saying, well, this is not translated correctly, so we go back to the Hebrew. And doing that in a population in which maybe 90% of the people are not blonde and white-skinned, but the idea of beauty is precisely that, you know, it's like this Hollywood actresses that became the paradigm of beauty. And say, but the Bible says, I'm dark and I'm beautiful. And that's very empowering for women who are of indigenous, of African descendants. And then we look at the relationship between men and women in these texts, and we see that is something new for men to exercise and rehearse as well. It's not only for women, it's like how do men relate to women also in this biblical context. And we are, I mean, it's quite exciting at this point to see Bible studies when husbands and wives come and we talk about how can a text like this, in which a man and a woman deal with each other in such with affection, with tenderness, with care, with love, how can that be in the Bible? Well, that's part of humans' lives, and doesn't need to be all related to the spirit. It needs to relate also to the well-being of bodies. And talking about gender relations, and how does that then lead us to revise our own way? So we compare what is described here with the way that men and women deal in our daily society. So that was, you know, jogging through what we have been doing in terms of reading the Bible in Latin America. Maybe I should have broken it up a little bit, you know, more going into the text. But remember that I asked you to think about if there's one character, one person, one name in the Bible that is important to you and that you would wish to lift up at this moment. Remember that I asked you about this? If I ask you about, you know, which character in the Bible serves as a model for you, what would you say?
Junia in Romans 16.
Romans 16, have you read that chapter? Have you read this chapter, Romans 16? Okay, write these texts down. You read it afterwards. It's fascinating. Barbara, I think you people in the seminary have to do your job a little bit better, you know? I'm presupposing here.
So with that one, people, if they want to find a very short article, I think it's Peter Inza.
Very good.
And it's a very short article, but she does a very good job in doing that.
And here, and on that one, you have to look in the NRSV to even see that it's a woman. The old, the RSV has it be a man. Uh-huh. Junius, but now we realize it's actually a woman who's an apostle. So that would be, that translation will have it as a man.
Let's see here. This is at the end of the book of the letter of Romans, and there is a list of people who are greeted. And in this list, there are many, many, many women. And the text gives itself away when it says in verse 7, it says, greet Andronicus and Junius. And here it says kinsmen, but it's folks, my friends, and my fellow prisoners. It's mistranslated here. There are people of note among the apostles, and they were in Christ before me. Meaning to say that there was a woman called Junia who was an apostle. No? Mm-hmm. Most of us don't even know about this, but you know, the text gives itself away and gives such interesting information. So, who else?
So, just one question. So you're saying apostle, like in terms of one of the, not the broader band of disciples, but like, one of the 12.
Well, no, like Paul called himself an apostle.
Okay.
And so she would be like he is. Okay. He acknowledges her as an apostle, even though Acts wouldn't, maybe. Acts never calls Paul an apostle, but Paul uses the term more broadly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Before Paul. She is an apostle.
Well, actually, I was thinking not so much of a character, but something like reading the book of the Song of Solomon, which I love and find beautiful, but one thing that I'm drawn to in it is not, when we read it, we often see the lover as a certain gender and the beloved as another
Yeah.
You know, it's very marital and people, and sometimes it's inescapable just simply because of the body parts that are being described. But what I find more instructive and beautiful is to remove that sensibility and to view the beloved as male, the lover as female, or to view them both as analogous to.
That's what we are doing at this point, revising all these gender stereotypes, mm-hmm. you know, who takes the initiative and things like that.
Because it I think, can be a beautiful description of relationship on some level.
Sure. Who else? Yeah?
Do the feminist theologians in Latin America and Brazil, are they exploring any of the extra-canonical texts, like the Acts of Thecla or the Gospel of Mary or something like that, that lifts women to use up?
Yeah. Can I just tell you one example? We had in the congregation I was working as a pastor, we had an ecumenical Bible study group composed only by women. There were about 20 women. We met once a month, and we met in different churches. Then when we met in the Lutheran churches, so one of our, myself or one person from the congregation would prepare the Bible study. And then when we met with the Methodist, and then somebody from the Methodist church would be prepared. And then in the Roman Catholic Church, somebody from the Roman Catholic Church would prepare. And then one day we met at the Roman Catholic Church, and one of the teachers had prepared this beautiful Bible study. And the Bible studies are always like communal. We discuss the text together. You know, somebody prepares, but it's all elaborated together. It's not one person comes and does a sermon or do a lecture on this. It's part of the style in which we also work. And this teacher had prepared a chosen text from the book of Judith. And here were these Methodist and Lutheran women, you know, kind of like looking, where is this book of Judith, you know? And so we kept browsing from back to forth and going from cover to cover, and I kept thinking to myself, uh-oh. And then finally they said, we can't find it here. And I said, well, it's because the Roman Catholic Bible has some books more than the Protestant Bible. And the Protestant women were, you know, very irritated, said, what else doesn't our Bible doesn't have? What else are we missing? You know, they're quite upset. And I said, well, you see, and I had to explain to them how the Bible come to be as a canon, as a collection of books, that many of them had been left out. And to give such examples of what had been left out, I told the story of Thecla, and how powerful that story had been. But because people thought it was like a novel and not really part of the profile of the Acts itself, that it had not become part of the canon. Well, the women only wanted to study the apocryphal material thereafter, because they thought that that was much more interesting than anything that they had ever seen. So we did some studies in that particular group, but we thought that we should first draw all the resources that we had in the canon and also in the ecumenical setting. So. Our time is up, folks. If you want to, we can talk afterwards, but I want to let our Cape minister go. So thank you.